Harry's delivers a close, comfortable shave at a fair price, still as low as just $2 per refill. And Harry's blades are designed to stay sharp. In a recent study, guys who shave four times a week say their eighth shave was as smooth as their first. And they can do it because they bought the factory in Germany that's been making precision-engineered blades for over 100 years. There's no gimmicky features, fair prices, and 100% satisfaction guaranteed on Harry's.com. Harry's is giving their best offer to Bernstein and Rahimi listeners. New Harry's customers can get a starter set at harrys.com/danb. You'll get a 5-blade razor, a weighted ergonomic handle, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover, a $13 value, all for just $3. There's never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/danb to redeem your offer today.
Summer is about relaxing. Just you and your thoughts.
Boring. Luckily, summer is also about America's Got Talent.
Are you ready?
Mind-boggling acts.
Put on your seatbelts.
Huge surprises. Ow! And $1 million on the line. So don't just summer. Summer with AGT. America's Got Talent, summer's number one show, premieres tonight on NBC.
Dan Bernstein, Layla Rahimi, on the way in 60 seconds on The Score.
Hey, it's Dustin. AutoZone has more ways for you to get what you need fast and start the job your way with their free next day delivery. You don't even have to leave the house. And with free same day store pickup, you can get in and out.
Get in the zone, AutoZone.
This segment is brought to you by Lakeside Bank, where every client has their own banker. Lakeside Bank, it's about time.
Broadcasting live from the Hyundai Studios, presented to you by your local Hyundai dealers. You're listening to Chicago's number one sports station. 670 The Score is Chicago Sports. Chicago Sports is The Score. An Odyssey station, WSCR and HD Chicago, WBMX HD2 Chicago.
The Score!
This hour is brought to you by Vasectomy Clinics of Chicago.
Hamilton to left. McKenna back at the wall. It is gone! Billy Hamilton squares up another baseball. And it's 1-0 Sox.
Well, Billy Hamilton has been a revelation for our Sox. Credit the front office, all of the evaluation guys who went out and said, you know what, we can use this guy. Rick Hahn, Kenny Williams said, you know, he's a great insurance policy.
Well, we know he can run, and right now he's sort of outperforming himself of late at the plate. So just enjoy.
Yep.
I would say just enjoy. And it's not necessarily predictive of anything else that's going to happen, but if he's doing it, let's just hope that he keeps doing it. The White Sox have a 3.5 game lead right now.
Yeah. That wasn't exactly a vote of confidence. But you're right. We have to appreciate this flash in the pan from the quintessential flash in the pan that is Billy Hamilton. He was used in the right ways and the ideal ways also. And I think that that stands to be discussed. He was your extra inning man. He stole third and then comes home on the Jose Abreu sacrifice fly. And that's how you get it done.
Who do you think is leading the White Sox in wins above replacement per Fangraphs?
Oh, wins above replacement.
Yep.
So who
do you think right now has accrued the most value of all White Sox position players?
Here's the problem. So I would say Jose Abreu, but at first that becomes a very dicey conversation. Is it Billy Hamilton?
Oh, God, no.
Okay. I don't know, man. I'm riding that wave.
I thought you were going to say Yermin, but it is not. The White Sox best player right now, and currently he is fourth in the American League. He is eighth overall in baseball. He's the eighth most valuable player in baseball. He is a positive player as a base runner, as a hitter, and as a defender. It's Yoan Moncada.
Who saw that coming?
After after last year when he dealt with COVID, Yoan Moncada. Right now, your WAR leaders right now, Vlad Guerrero Jr. is at 3.1. Nick Castellanos and Max Muncy are at 2.8. Chris Bryant and Marcus Semien are at 2.7. Xander Bogaerts, 2.5. Ronald Acuna Jr., 2.4. Yoan Moncada, just percentage points below him, also at 2.4.
And I joke when I say who saw that coming. Please do not think I was being serious, because this is the guy that we all thought he was going to be right now.
That's what you traded for.
Amen.
That's what you traded for. Jose Abreu is 29th at 1.6, because you know he's going to be a negative defensively and as a base runner.
Fair.
So that's all going to be with the bat. But Moncada's an all-star. Plain and simple.
Moncada is the guy you expected him to be. He has met the expectation and had a heck of a music video. We can't even criticize it because it has taken nothing away from his game performance.
Yeah, they've got some handsome guys on that team. They really do. They've
my favorite moment was still the thirst Twitter getting a hold of the NBC Sports Chicago post of admiring the chains on the players that they got to wear during the games. And it was Luis Robert, Yoan Moncada, and I believe Abreu. And the replies were just golden.
Luis Robert is a model. That guy's a jeans model. I mean, absolutely, completely symmetrical facial features. I mean, he's a very handsome man. But Yoan's got all the drip going with his romper and everything in the video and the women posing on the lounge chairs in front of him. He rocks
the flair and backs it up. What can we say?
Do we know what your means medallion is?
No, but also, is it an appropriate time to ask about whether or not the Sox bring the home run chain back? And that thing would get passed around quite a bit. As far as you saying Tony La Russa lost in the right way, explain yourself.
Sort of like what I used to say about Ozzie Guillen is knowing when not to chase a game. When you're starting Jimmy Lambert and you get down early and you're coming off what you're coming off of, you're looking at a schedule, just knowing, living to fight another day. I always thought Ozzie was great at that. That Ozzie was really good about managing pitching leverage and knowing when it was someone's day to maybe eat some rough innings out there and seeing that, you know, you got a bullpen on fumes. Giolito was a soldier in picking up the innings that he did. And I kept watching the bullpen and thinking, why is nobody warming? And it's because so many guys were down, and Ethan Katz goes to talk to him and Giolito says, I got more in the tank, and knowing that he could just pound strikes and try to use his defense if he had to. But I do think there's something to be said for knowing that it's 162 and knowing when to husband your resources.
Okay, fair. However, I will present to you in return the seventh inning.
Okay.
Second game, seventh inning, being the 3-1 loss, where Jake Lamb singles off of Class A to get on base. And then instead of having Danny Mendick with TA available, and Andrew Vaughn available, even though I know allergies were said it could be a problem for Andrew Vaughn, but let's face it,
Cottonwood's bad right now.
We've all been there. Larry Garcia is then the pinch hitter. And Larry Garcia works a 3-pitch at bat, swinging at every single cutter offering from Class A. Then you have Billy Hamilton, who strikes out swinging, also on a 3-pitch at bat. And then you have Nick Madrigal, also on a 3-pitch at bat, the end.
That's what it's Mendick, Madrigal, Mendick, Madrigal, Madrigal, Mendick, Madrigal.
Correct. Right? Yeah. But you have the tying run at the plate. And you pinch hit Larry Garcia when TA is available.
That's the second time that's happened on a day off for Tim Anderson. We can go back and I forget which game it was, but there was another game where he made that same decision. Maybe he's got some kind of deal with Anderson where he says, your day off is your day off. Don't even bother putting on cleats. There's no way he could think that any one of those guys is a better matchup than a guy who's been the American League's leading hitter for average.
And I love Larry Garcia. I have always been a Larry Garcia proponent. I thought when he's used in the right ways, especially before the injuries made it super difficult, I thought he was used properly. He does everything that he's asked to do with skill and competence and is a professional. But in that case, I don't think that's the guy to face Class A.
No, but no one's likely to do anything against Class A,
except your leadoff batter.
But it marginally increases the likelihood. I agree with you on that. I agree. I never thought the White Sox were going to win that game at any point.
But they had the chance. Like, numerically, you had the tying run at the plate. And you had already somehow gotten a single out of Jay Clamb, which shout out to Chris Kamka for tweeting Jay Clamb. But you know what I'm getting at here is yeah. That was still an opportunity.
I agree. Look, my any compliment of Tony La Russa's managerial tactical chops is going to come grudgingly here. So if you know, take one when you can get one.
And I'm not trying to diss on La Russa personally. This is just a baseball discussion that I feel like stands to be pointed out. Like, that's something that I would point out no matter who the manager is. I think it's silly that I have to couch that argument in such a way. Also, huge bright spot in Ryan Burr coming back. And yeah. Ending in a third scoreless. That Sox pen needed him.
Yeah, that's pretty cool to see. And I don't know how deep they're going to get in some of those guys. When people were saying great things about, is it Jonathan Stever? Then every time we see him at the big league level, he's like, what are you so excited about?
It's very difficult, though, to be put in the position that Stever's put in, where he gets brought back from Charlotte. He knows it's a spot start, and he's facing, right now, the other biggest contender in the division. It's a doubleheader situation. And his job is to make it as hard as possible for them to send him down. And then 3 2/3, he's done for the day. And then he has to go right back to Charlotte. That's a difficult spot to be in, I think, for any young pitcher.
And where are we on Adam Eaton's health? Is he healthy or is he not? It was obviously good to see him run into one yesterday. But I don't know if he's bad because he's bad or he's bad because he's hurt.
I think that's a fair question. But are you really okay with the answer if he is hurt? Because then... you're really hoping that the health of the outfield happens quickly.
Yeah, they're still going to need to bolster their outfield. If they want to win a World Series, Adam Engel coming back will help. And I don't know when that's coming either. I don't know if there's another setback there. I don't know if the timetable changed. I keep reading about him doing sort of exercise. I just want to know, because as we draw closer, as this starts to matter, and if indeed this is going to be their division and their opportunity, I don't want them going out like last year. And this current outfield is not one that appears poised to win a World Series.
Well, and here's the other concern is the discussion seems to center around the idea that because of the speed and the just absolute ups required out of Engel's game when it comes to how he plays in the outfield, that they want him at that level. But I would argue that you can get there in major league competition as well, especially with this pitching staff, right?
Yes. But you need some thunder. This team is still, but look how they win these games too.
You're not depending on Adam Engel for his bat before the 2020 season.
I want the bat that started near the end of September of 2019 I want the launch angle bat. He's a big man who can get the ball up in the air. Look, here's what's funny and what's sort of ironic about this is they were helped to win games by Billy Hamilton hitting home runs, by Adam Eaton hitting a home run. Don't lose the thread here where it's about them hitting homers and they're pitching preventing homers. That's modern baseball, and it really applies to the White Sox. That's been the story. When they homer and the other team doesn't, they win.
However, the White Sox of all teams can have the offense as a team to have a high-ranking offense and a productive offense without needing all the homers.
Yeah, but they still need them, though. No one has an offense. Nobody hits. The league's hitting .230. No, everybody strikes out 30% of the time. It's walks and home runs. That's all anybody really does. And occasionally when you see Nick Madrigal get a triple to drive in a run, that's all great. And we celebrate those things. We remember those things. But over time, it's just going to be making sure those home runs are for multiple runs.
I understand what you say the league averages, but this was a team that was built to do other things than that. So, yes. Be excited about Adam Engel and his hopefully likely soon return. But also understand that you weren't depending on that guy offensively as a major cog until very recently, relatively speaking, to his career.
The main reason they're winning outside of their starting pitching staff is on base percentage. What they're doing is crazy. And we can get into weighted on base and all that, but just overall, OBP. The White Sox are at 343. leading all of baseball. On-base percentage is life. It is the lifeblood of scoring. It's just the easiest thing to understand. It's not out percentage. And eventually, the guys who are not out score. And if you don't make outs, you score an infinite number of runs. Like, if you had to look at one number that's defining what they're doing, it's on-base percentage. They're drawing their walks, they're getting on, and then you get enough thunder behind that, and you win a lot of baseball games. But you still got to deliver, and you just can't count on stringing hits together. Whether it's against, I mean, I know it's not going to happen against Emmanuel Clase, but if they keep up that on-base percentage, if that's sustainable, they're going to run away with this division. They're going to run away and hide.
But still, in the ninth inning, I understand you're facing the best closer in your division, but there are other options.
I would prefer to have him hit in the last at bat. I don't know what was going on. Maybe there was an extenuating circumstance, and I will allow for that. That sometimes a guy either just didn't feel right or was otherwise unavailable for some reason. If available, you would prefer that one of your top hitters take that at bat over a bad hitter. I think that's not debatable.
Also, just as a follow-up, because Dan and I have gotten a lot of blow-up about this whole cup snake talk phenomenon here. If I could somehow influence everybody just by talking about something, I'd be commanding an army. What is wrong with you guys? I don't control the will of the people. I just observe and report.
How dare you take away cup snakes?
Clearly, this is all my decision. Well, if that's the case, I'll just start raising my hand and lifting the tide in Lake Michigan. What?
Well, people think that when you say it, it means that it's some sort of like papal bull, or it's just like the royal fiat.
Yes, army, please do this because I willed it so. No, I would seriously be commanding armies and stuff. I would do something useful with it.
Is this right from the 941? The White Sox have only won 4 games when they didn't homer. It sounds like it should be right. That wouldn't surprise me. I'm not going to go sort of fact check it now, but that is... That's about right, but that's baseball now. That's what baseball is because of velocity and stuff. But Joe Sheehan's newsletter today has a lot of the receipts on what's going on with baseball and what they've done to the ball and how that's sort of wrecked everything and it's backfiring on them. Oh, boy.
But look up the home run independent batting average, the team average and the offensive production outside of the home run. And that's where the Sox still play.
That's Layla Rahimi. I'm Dan Bernstein. We have a fun conversation coming back. We're going to go inside the conditioning secrets of athletes as successful and disparate as Phil Mickelson and Lance Lynn. Their performance coach that they share, Sean Cochran, gives us his secrets next on The Score.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com. Chicago Sports Station.
It's very possible that this is the last tournament I ever win. Like, if I'm being real, but it's also very possible that I may have had a little bit of a breakthrough in some of my focus, and maybe I go on a little bit of a run. I don't know. But the point is that there's no reason why I or anybody else can't do it at a later age. It just takes a little bit more work.
Takes more work, and it takes more intelligent, more informed work, and advisors helping out on how to do it. That was Phil Mickelson, PGA champion at age 50, almost 51. Pretty incredible stuff. Meanwhile, Lance Lynn of the White Sox at age 34 has been worth 1.6 wins above replacement this year and has an earned run average of 1.37. And I think the secret to all that has to be our next guest. He is Sean Cochran. He is on Twitter at Sean_Cochran. And he is the performance coach for both Phil Mickelson and Lance Lynn. And he's with us on Bernstein and Rahimi on The Score. Hey, Sean, how are you? These are fun times for you.
Yeah, very exciting. Thanks for having me on, guys. Hope all is well in Chicagoland.
Well, things are good here. Lance Lynn, a big part of it. And let's talk first about him, because I was intrigued when I read the article in The Athletic that we look at him and we don't see a classically designed professional athlete. And it was very important for you to say that we have to think of the effective usage of his frame and what he does for a living and how it's okay for him to look like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I get this question all the time, to be honest. And what I will say is, you know, I feel as though the general public is misinformed, and their perception of what an athlete looks like is incorrect. And I would say that's a resultant of social media, marketing, et cetera. You know, I would say an athlete, by definition, is an individual who is physiologically prepared to execute what they're required to do in competition to the best of their ability, you know, under duress during, you know, 18 holes of golf, between the lines, pitching nine innings, et cetera. So, and I don't know if that article from The Athletic, you know, went into detail. The reporter I was talking to in regard to that, we discussed BMI, and I don't know if you're familiar with BMI. It's a very common, you know, formula utilized to determine the level of health, wellness, and fitness within the general population. And the discussion went that, you know, many athletes would be considered obese or out of shape if they're measured via BMI. And one of the individuals, the reporter I was talking to, discussed said that Mike Trout, according to his information, would be considered obese via a BMI analysis. So, you know, so take it as what you will, but just in terms of, you know, what the general population views as being athletic, I would say is vastly skewed in regards to what we see in professional athletics, being baseball, football, basketball, golf, et cetera. It's basically your athlete needs to execute under pressure, you know, what they're required to do during competition.
Well,
and that's what we physiologically prepare them to do. Yeah, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, I'm sorry to passionately agree with you on this, but I do
think that
BMI is really inaccurate because it doesn't take into account the significant volume and weight of muscle. And you bring up a good point there.
Yeah, it's a lack of information, education, and understanding via the general public. And I mean, I would say probably every NFL offensive and defensive lineman would probably be considered obese via the BMI. I mean, I mean that's a pretty general statement, but I would say that is most likely going to be correct. So yeah, it's just perception. I mean, we see all this marketing, we see all this information on social media that skews our perception via the general public to, well, this is what an athlete should look like. And I will tell you, no, that is not what an athlete should look like. An athlete should be prepared to do what they're required to earn their paycheck and perform, you know, between the lines, on the golf course, on the football field, et cetera.
Yeah, I'd like to see a sumo wrestler told he needs to slim down because he's unhealthy, and saying, you know,
right,
you know, you got, I have a job to do here, and I kind of need to look like this. But I would be curious to know what the coaching, the performance coaching of Mickelson and Lynn shares in common, in that they're both initiators of action rather than reactors. Mm-hmm. Like a defensive back has to react. A baseball hitter has to react, where both Mickelson and Lynn have to, there's the mental side of what shot am I going to hit? What club am I going to use? What pitch am I going to throw to what spot? And then it's a matter of knowing there's a swing or a delivery, a movement that can be replicated in a way that is effective and comfortable.
Sure. So let me just, I'm going to break it down just into components first and foremost, is that, you know, a pitcher, golfer, professional level player, basically they have to, you know, utilize the biomechanics of their pitching motion, their swinging motion, with the goal of executing that motion with the greatest amount of efficiency and delivering the greatest amount of energy into golf club or baseball at the end of the motion or impact. Now, that being said, you know, not getting into too much detail, it all starts with what we call ground reaction forces. Lance, when he's pitching, pushes off the ground on the mound to begin the generation of energy into release point. And then what he needs to do in an efficient manner is take that energy, continue to translate that energy through the body to his release point and actually add energy during that action until he releases the baseball. Now with Mickelson, same thought processes with the golf swing. If he's got driver on the tee box, you know, that swing basically is initiated with the backswing, top of backswing. And then at that point, you've loaded the body, and that load is going to again start from the feet, work up the body, into the impact position to the club. And during that time, what he needs to do is he needs to, number one, generate as much speed as possible and efficiently translate that energy into the golf club. Now, with both the pitcher and the golfer there, it's a repetitive movement. Lance has to, you know, throw the baseball X amount of times per inning, you know, every 5 days during the course of the season. And Phil needs to, you know, perform that action over and over again over a four-day period during a tournament. So in order to replicate that and create efficiency, there's a skill side of the equation where these individuals will work on the actual pitching motion or actual swinging motion. And then my job is basically to assure that these individuals have the physiological requirements to execute that athletic action over and over and over again efficiently and be able to maintain those workloads throughout the course of a game, you know, a tournament, a season, et cetera. So well, I hope I didn't get into too much detail.
No, I wouldn't mind even there. I wouldn't mind even more, frankly.
Yeah. So let's just take Lance for an example. So in order to execute the pitching motion, there has to be certain levels of joint mobility, muscular flexibility, muscular strength, and power to actually execute that pitching motion efficiently. And, you know, the research is out there through biomechanical analysis studies, et cetera. We know all that information. So there's a baseline. So then my job with Lance is to, one, number one, you know, assess him as an individual pitcher, determine where he is relative to the baselines, and then look at what I need to work on with him within those categories in order to, you know, prepare him so he physiologically has the ability to execute his pitching motion efficiently. And then with that, as Lance, you said, he just turned 34. I've got to take in and individualize his programming to account to what he is, you know, where he is physically in terms of, you know, his career, what he's being asked from the coach in regards to the staff and how what he's supposed to throw, et cetera. And if I shift gears to Mickelson, you know, same concept is that we know what is required in terms of the physiological requirements to execute a proficient golf swing. And then we assess the individuals to determine their baselines and see where they're at, where their deficiencies are and where the efficiencies are. We address the deficiencies and then we build the efficiencies so he, as a professional golfer, can perform that athletic action over and over and over again, you know, each and every 18 holes and every tournament and throughout our entire season. So, you know, that's how we do it in a nutshell. And I'll say as a sports performance individual, as a coach, you have to understand the biomechanics of the sport because that is going to determine what is physiologically required to execute those biomechanics efficiently. If an individual is inefficient, the body has to work harder to perform the action. And if the body has to work harder over time, those workloads increase and the propensity for injury or a lack of success or a lack of velocity or a lack of club head speed is going to creep into the equation.
Well, and I think you described what a lot of us describe in Lance Lynn. The traditional baseball phrase is rubber arm. And It's describing something that we don't exactly know what we're seeing. Of course, we think it's the arm. But you said it the best to James Feagott in The Athletic when you said he has a naturally efficient body style and one that is able to replicate over and over again his throwing motion. And it's that idea of being naturally efficient that I think we as sports fans don't exactly know how to describe. So tell us what we're supposed to look for when you say that.
Well, what you're supposed to look for, and it gets beyond just the two dimensions and what you are visually seeing with your eyeballs, because in sport today, we utilize what we call 3D motion analysis. So we're looking at the athletes via three dimensions, and we're digitizing their pitching motions, their swinging motions, and we're utilizing that information and comparing it to a database within our computer systems to determine the efficiencies. And this can certainly be, you know, what type of internal, external rotation does the athlete need to, you know, properly deliver energy to the upper extremities to release the baseball. So from a visual standpoint, from the general population, you're not necessarily going to see it. And, you know, what I go to is regards to, we have pitching styles, we have swinging styles, and, you know, there's many different styles. For example, how, you know, Mickelson swings the golf club, and how I'm going to go back a few years, say Ernie Els swings the golf club, or an individual such as, let's say, just DJ, Justin Johnson swings the golf club. I think we can agree that those three individuals who are very successful in their careers on the PGA Tour, they visually look different. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you can't, what DJ does on his front side, you really can't teach anybody to do, because his frame and his remarkable strength allows him to do something most golfers can't with that particular action.
Yes, and that is correct. So that's a physiological side. But if we took Mickelson, DJ, and Ernie, and we digitized their swings via biomechanical analysis, and we put them next to each other on a screen, the energy generation and translation would look very, very similar. And unless you know what you're looking for, it would be very, very difficult for an individual to determine which golfer is which.
Wow.
So that's how in depth you get with it. And I'll say this, and, you know, I've done the motion analysis, biomechanics on, you know, hitters in MLB, and then you look at golfers, and you can take the biomechanical analysis of 3D digitization of a hitter and a golfer, put them side by side, they look very, very, very similar. So it starts to get very difficult to tell. So I would say, just from, you know, just from, you know, two dimensions and eyeballs, it's hard to see. But I think what you can certainly key in on is, if you're watching a pitcher, you know, how laborious or how much labor does it look like they're utilizing to throw the baseball? That can be an indicator, but I'm not going to stake my bank account on it visually. So how hard does it look like the pitcher is working to deliver that baseball? That can be somewhat of just a view from your eyeballs in regards to seeing that. But yeah, Lance is very, very efficient in what he does. Phil's very efficient in what he does. Most professional athletes across all sports are very efficient in regards to those athletic actions, or they wouldn't be there.
Well, and then quickly before we let you go, I know you have some videos that are a little older on the Golf Channel explaining and on YouTube too, explaining Phil's mobility exercises. You also talk about some other strength exercises. So if you're just giving regular golfer listening to our station right now, or maybe a kid who's playing baseball, your favorite drills to do or exercise for strength and mobility, what would you say?
Sure. Well, first off, for the golfing population out there, especially for the majority of individuals, don't think that if you buy a brand new driver every year, you're going to become a better golfer, because it's basically based upon your mechanics and your body. So if I look at any golfer, baseball player, et cetera, I'm going to first and foremost, hip mobility. You've got to have mobility in the hips and utilize the exercise to address hip mobility, thoracic spine mobility, shoulder mobility. So those three components. And then from there, I would say, and it's, again, it's become a term that's thrown around a lot, core strength, your lumbopelvic hip complex, which is all the muscles on the front sides and back of your body, from just above your knees to slightly below your chest. They need to be strong and stable, number one, to maintain postural positions, as well as translate energy and generate energy in those motions. So hips, shoulders, thoracic spine, and core. That's where I'd go.
Awesome.
There you have it. You just took two off your handicap right there and lowered your...
I would hope so.
Sean Cochran, thank you for taking the time for us today. This is great.
Thank you.
Hey, thanks much. Have a great afternoon. Thank you again.
That is performance coach Sean Cochran, making the most of both Phil Mickelson, Lance Lynn, and others. We have 71 seconds of hockey next on Bernstein Rahimi on The Score.
The Score is Chicago sports.
Chicago sports is The Score.
Thanks for keeping us the number one and most listened to sports station in Chicago. Listen on your radio, laptop, mobile device through the Odyssey app, or tell your smart speaker to play 670 The Score.
We're live and we're local.
670 The Score. An Odyssey station.
This is Sports Radio 670 The Score and 670thescore.com, Chicago Sports Station.
This pass gets away, rolls out of the zone, and the Montreal Canadiens have completed the comeback. Shock and awe in Toronto. The Montreal Canadiens are on to the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
NHL on NBC. It wasn't supposed to be like that. That's not what they signed up for in Toronto. Not only do they lose and they blow the lead, and they lose to their French-Canadian rivals.
Fail.
Glorious.
But isn't it kind of expected? Because as I was reminded in 2019 of the rally in Toronto, or as they like to say, Toronto, there was the funniest sign I had seen in a long time. And that sign said, just make it to the second round. And it didn't happen then either.
So to the uninitiated, Jay Zawoski, what is the particular flavor of Schadenfreude here being enjoyed across the hockey world?
Toronto considers itself the capital of hockey. Okay, so we took a trip up there, I think it was 03. First place we went out for dinner, and a fight broke out in a Leafs game, and everything in the restaurant stopped. The server stopped, the cook stopped, everybody stopped to watch the fight. It was like someone hit pause in reality, and then time restarted. That's how crazy hockey is in Toronto. Toronto fans think of themselves as Yankees fans, like they're the authority because they're Leafs fans, but the Leafs haven't won since 1967. So they have this undeserved arrogance. Yes, you're from Canada. That doesn't automatically make you the best fan base. There's other teams in Canada that could probably claim that before the Leafs can. It's just really nice to see a team with that sort of arrogance lose. Just like American sports fans love to watch the Yankees lose.
But the Yankees
but the
back
Yankees
it up.
Are good. Yeah. Yes, they've had a history of success. I'm trying to think of the American equivalent of the Leafs. And it might be the Bears.
Cowboys, maybe.
Yeah, but the Cowboys have won.
It's been 20 years.
In the HD TV era, maybe. I don't know.
No.
It's just, I don't know. Cowboys are maybe a good comparison with the arrogance of the fans. Because Bears fans are kind of downtrodden at this point. So Cowboys might be the comp. But 1967? And the thing is, they've done everything right. They brought in the young GM. They're all analytics. They've signed the veterans and developed the kids. They've done everything right, and it hasn't worked. And now they're sort of saying, like, what do we do now? They really shouldn't do anything. What they've done is correct. They just need the players to execute. And that's what they were up 3-1 in the series, and they're 0-8 in their last opportunities to clinch a series. 0-8.
They haven't won a playoff series since 2004.
This was a legit cup contender, this team. Like, you can make the argument, Colorado, Vegas, you know, there's some other teams that, you know, obviously Tampa, and the Leafs were in that conversation, and now they're gone. It's unreal. And you knew when that game 7 started and the Canadiens scored first, that game was over. You just knew it. It just had that feeling, even as hard as Toronto tried to get back in it. It just did not work. You saw the frustration, and every second that ticked by, it just was more of a certainty. It was beautiful.
Yeah, this is. I think that those who are saying that these fans are like Knicks fans.
That's it. That's
that
the
really
cop.
Where that's it. They haven't won since 1973, and there's been this like, well, basketball's better when the Knicks are good. And I agree, MSG is an awesome place, and it may be my favorite place to watch an NBA game, with all things considered, but. And everybody on All Things Considered there. But if I think that's probably the best, because they think that they're better fans and that they're watching. So they have an entitlement, I guess, is the term.
I do agree with that statement, though, that hockey is better with the Leafs. Basketball is better with the Knicks being good because it gives everyone else someone to hate. And that makes it more interesting.
I never even thought about it like that.
Everybody hates the Knicks. Right? Like it's.
No, I really like the Knicks right now because of Taj and D Rose and Tibbs.
I think the idea of the Knicks, though, is hated. Like,
yes.
This iteration is somewhat acceptable because of those relationships we have. But overall, the Knicks is a franchise. Ugh, no one likes them.
Well, And they've done themselves no favors prior to this regime taking over, that's for sure.
Yeah, the 312 wants to know, why is MSG the mecca of basketball? If you've been there...
The sound of it.
Oh, my God. It's the organ. It's the sound. It's the feeling of like descending into that building. Just the way it's laid out. I can't explain it. The smell.
Versus the Staples Center.
I've never been to the Staples Center.
And the theater lighting. And the
I've never been to the Staples Center. I've never experienced that. But experiencing playoff MSG in the day and the crackle of intensity in that building, just and I don't know the way it's lit, the elevator ride. I don't know. It's kind of dingy, just enough dingy without being a total dump. And maybe they fixed it up over the years, but it's just for me, it was the sound.
This is also getting us into a topic we should probably discuss in slower sports times. Just teams and fan bases you love to hate. Because, yes, in Chicago, we're going to get the typical rivalry discussion. But you bring up a larger point, Jay. The reason of sports being better when teams you love to hate are good.
And united in hatred. The entire country united in hatred against them. Like
country.
The Cowboys and the Knicks. And the Leafs in Canada.
Notre Dame getting some comps here.
I'm a Notre Dame fan, and that is accurate. That is accurate.
But nothing is seemingly as futile because the Leafs have had their fair share of chances. Like, other teams haven't even made it to the playoffs at certain times.
Oh, yeah, they've had chances. And like I said, they've done everything correctly. It's just, I don't think anyone should be fired. The players just need to put the puck in the net better. That's really it. That's all there is to it.
I still cannot get over that sign. Just make it to the second round. That was the funniest sports sign I've ever seen.
There's your expectations in Toronto.
We will do transition with Lawrence Holmes next on The Score.
Former major leaguer and MLB insider Cody Decker covers baseball with Bernstein and Rahimi tomorrow morning at 11 on The Score.
How is Tony La Russa still in charge of the Chicago White Sox? It is insane.
Listen to Cody Decker talk Chicago baseball with Bernstein and Rahimi tomorrow at 11 a.m. on Sports Radio 670 The Score and Odyssey Station.